For the last 2 weeks, we've been making our way through the letter to Hebrews. We have pondered its examples of faithful living. We have explored its warnings against rejecting God's grace, or rather, the peace we might claim in opening ourselves to it. Images of faith ancestors erupting mountains have painted a picture of a powerful God who longs for us to live in relationship with God and with each other. The book of Hebrews is powerful, it's poetic, it's philosophical, theological, and at times, overly intellectual. Consequently, it can be a struggle to get through. But then I suppose that's fair to say with 90% of this holy book of ours. One would be wise to tread carefully through its pages, as it's easy to get lost in them. But Hebrews is also deeply rooted in a faith that binds us to the new covenant Jesus placed in our hands so long ago, and connects us to an ancient history that will feed and sustain us through the twists and turns of our lives, if we let it. Not unlike our society today, the people for whom we suspect Hebrews was originally written were living in a time where it was a challenge to live sacred lives in a world that scoffed at such leanings. Status and wealth were the visible signs of success and divine favor, and the ultimate providers of power. The idea of welcoming strangers, visiting those in prison, and freeing oneself from the love of money were then, as they tend to be now, unpopular. The closing chapter that we are offered today attempts to pull all that has been written so far together in its opening line, "Let mutual love continue." And from there remind the readers that what our faith ultimately calls us to do is live in loving and healthy relationships. The author then leaves their philosophical trend of speaking and continues with the list making, which of course I love, offering rather practical examples of what mutual love actually looks like. Where last week Moses and his mountain were used to enhance our understanding, today we are taken even farther back to the book of Genesis and that powerhouse faith combo, Abraham and Sarah. As you may recall, Abraham has been assured by God that his and Sarah's descendants would outnumber the stars. But years had passed since that promise was made, during which both Abraham and Sarah have grown old and have yet to conceive. The day the author of Hebrews brings to our attention is a fateful one. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for by doing that, some have entertained angels without knowing it, he wrote. And in our mind's eye, we can imagine Abraham sitting outside his tent when three men appear. They are strangers to the village. And yet, instantly, Abraham jumps into action. "My Lord, if I find favor with you, do not pass by your servant. Let a little water be brought and wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree. Let me bring a little bread that you may refresh yourselves, and after that you may pass on." So they said, "Do as you have said." And Abraham hastened into the tent to Sarah and said, "Make ready quickly 3 measures of choice flour, knead it, and make cakes." Abraham ran to the herd and took a calf, tender and good, and gave it to the servant who hastened to prepare it. Then he took curds and milk and the calf that he had prepared and set it before the strangers. And he stood by them under the tree while they ate. We learn, of course, that the strangers are angels, and they have brought a message. One that brings hope to Abraham and laughter to Sarah, who, after running around and doing all the work, for the record, stands laughing and eavesdropping. I don't know if you caught that, but Abraham gets all the glory and he's telling everyone else what to do. Anyway, we'll go there another day. But Sarah, who's exhausted, standing in the corner eavesdropping, starts laughing. A baby would be in her arms within the year, the angel said. But more to the point, God had not forgotten them. God would keep his promise. And this, I think, is what the author of Hebrews may have wanted to convey more than anything else. with all the reliving of ancient stories in this book, and all the glorious to-do lists and practical advice that we've examined this past month, the ultimate message is, God keeps promises. God kept the promise given to Sarah and Abraham, and they named the baby Isaac, which means laughter. Imagine having such tangible proof of a promise fulfilled, the weight of a baby in ancient hands. Our job, I suppose, is to try and remember and remind each other that God will keep promises for us too. Jesus said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. Words of hope offered to a group of scared disciples who faced an uncertain future. Words the Hebrews were called to remember and that we are expected to cling to today, even though they have the tendency to slip through our fingers like sand. Even though the author tells us to claim this promise with confidence and without fear, it's hard. But I think the author knew it was hard. It's why he wrote it down. Why he left this litany of faith for us to remember so many of thousands of years later. We remember angelic strangers and erupting mountains and mistake-ridden saints, all offered to remind us that at the end of the day, God keeps promises. Read this with me. I will never leave you nor forsake you. This promise is what we have. It binds us to our faith history and pushes us towards the future. And out of it, we do what we can to let mutual love continue, to not give up on each other, or on ourselves, or this community we try to build, to not close the doors to others who long to find sanctuary here, to not live in fear of the future, but to hold fast to the truth that no matter what comes, God will be there in it with us. Glennon Doyle wrote, the only meaningful thing we can offer one another is love. Not advice, not questions about our choices, not suggestions for the future. Just love. Imagine if our love for each other could come even close to mirroring the love God has for us. Imagine if our love for ourselves could come even close. Sometimes I think that's the hardest part, you know, allowing ourselves to be loved. And maybe that's where we need to start. To look in that mirror and see reflected there the perfect image of God, totally beloved, utterly valued, desperately needed to build this kingdom God longs for us to build. And once we can do that, once we can see God's beauty and power and love in ourselves, then we can turn to the world and let it rush out of us like an unending river of grace. Then we can get busy. Then we can love our neighbor as ourselves. Then we can stand up in the face of our fear and demand justice for those who have no voice. Then we can stand on top of Mount Zion and sing hallelujah. It all starts with love. So, this new year, let's aim for that. Let's aim for more love, and let's see what happens.